and you're Dylan, right? Are you Matt?
No, I'm Matt.
You're Matt, all right. You Cameron? Were you here last class?
I don't think so.
All right. So I guess you're missing two in a row, does that sound right?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Just check. All right, so. Good news. Bad news. I will do the good news first as Dylan sits down and gets comfortable. Good news, well, actually, I don't even know if it's good news for you, but it's good news for me is that I finally got around to importing the Engage shell from the last time I ran this class, but I realized there's so much I gotta update it, so that's tomorrow's problem for me. So one of the things that you should have gotten a message from is that I plugged in the dates for the paper. So if you are highly motivated and you're gonna try to get the paper done quick, I will reward you with extra points. I think the dates that I set is if you get it in by the end of February, I'll add 10 points to it. If you get it in by the end of March, I'll add 5 points to it. And of course, the regular due date's on April 22nd. But as I always tell students, particularly if you've never had me before, which is like all of you except for one, make sure you go on the paper section of my website and read the instructions. My papers are designed not for me to have to act like an English professor. I don't like doing that. I'm not going to whip out the red pen and make the little new paragraphs and the little squiggles and all the other stuff. I don't do that. Instead, I grade it like an assignment, meaning I put a whole bunch of instructions up on the paper section telling you exactly how I want the paper to be written. If you follow those directions, even if you are an awful writer, you should be able to get a B. Because the most points I take off for bad grammar, bad spelling is 15 points. So if you follow everything else, you should be able to get a B. Now, do students fail? Oh, absolutely. And the reason why they fail is they don't follow the damn directions. So if you're going to go for the extra points, don't rush it in. Think you know what you're doing and drop it and be done with it. Because you may get those 10 extra points or those 5 extra points, but you lose 60 points because you didn't follow directions. Now the other thing is that you made me lose my train of thought.
So sorry.
I was going somewhere and it was going to be good.
15 points taken off.
Yeah, points taken off. I don't know where I was going with that. Oh, yeah. So if you read something on the website in the paper section that you do not understand, don't put your head in the sand. Come to class and ask me, hey, professor, on the website you said this. What does that mean? I will explain it to you. I promise. There's no tricks or traps. The only tricks or traps is if you are too shy to ask a question about something you don't understand. But if you have a question, there's a good chance someone else in the class has the same question. So if you ask it, I can answer it in front of everybody. And then everyone will know. Because I would have, particularly this is a small class, it should be an easy group for me to have everybody get A's on their papers. Follow the directions. All right, the other thing, so that was kind of the good news. The kind of the bad news is I might finish up for the test today, but I'm not ready to quite give you an exam today. So what we might have to do is we might have to do a situation, because we've been going early, I can't really, you know, I do gotta keep things moving forward, is I might have you put like a line in your notes and say this is the end of exam one, then give me a day to get the exam finished, and then have you take it after the fact. Because as I said on day one, for those of you who were not added in the class yet, you don't take your exams with me. You will take 3 of your exams online and Engage. So I will schedule it for a day that we don't have class, and you will basically have all day to take it. It opens up at 8 o'clock in the morning, it closes at 11 o'clock at night, or 11:59 at night. So all you'll need to do is just put aside an hour at some point and take the test.
Yes.
So is it just like multiple choice on the computer?
Mostly multiple choice, but I'll ask you a couple of essay questions.
Okay.
Nothing big that you can answer in a couple of seconds. It should not be that hard.
If you've been coming to class and taking notes and kind of paying attention. This first one might be a little challenging because we did kind of go way back and we talked about some weird names and stuff like that. So
keeping track of them might be hard. But again, if you're taking notes and you've been studying, you got the book, you're starting to read chapter one, you know, everything should fall into place.
Because as soon as we're done with this first step, we're going to quickly go through the first Indo-Chinese War, but we're going to focus on what America was doing. And then, by the third exam, we will be, well, Americans' boots will be on the ground, so to speak. All right. So, this early stage, something to remember is that Ho Chi Minh started off as a nationalist. His initial interest was liberating Vietnam from the clutches of the French. But when he went to Paris, he got exposed to socialism. And then he would eventually get exposed to Marxism. And then at one point, he would travel to Russia and get exposed to Leninism. So by the 1920s and 1930s, all of these ideas are going through his head. But at its core, the focus was still getting his people free by any means. So if that meant he had to be a communist to get independence, he would be a communist. If he had to be a capitalist, he would be a capitalist. Whatever it took. All right. He did attempt to start his first revolutionary party. He built it in China so he could not be tracked down and wiped out, following Lenin's model. But this first group met an untimely death. Because coincidentally, and it had nothing to do with Ho, Chiang Kai-shek decides he's going to wipe out the Chinese communists. But in doing so, he started attacking all of the communists. Because the only good commie in the minds of Chiang Kai-shek was a dead commie. Of course, as we know, it was reported that Ho was dead. Well, under his synonym, his fake name, Lin Tai. But he did manage to get out. He went back to Russia. He got admonished. Bad commie. Went to re-education camps. And then they sent him to Siam. So the guy who wants to get Vietnamese independence still has yet to set foot in his own country. Now, as it turns out, again, we don't know many details. The only details that we know of his travels are things that he shared later in life, and he didn't share much. But apparently, one of the things that concerned him once he arrived in Siam was he learned that the remnants of his group, the Thanh Nhien, had broken apart into smaller splinter groups. They separated from one another. These groups began acting independent of one another. And in a few instances, they actually started battling against one another. In Hanoi, the splinter cell there formed a group that they called the Communist Party of Indochina. In Saigon, in the south, the splinter group there formed a group called the Communist Party of Annam. Literally, they began battling one another more than they were battling the French, because both were trying to say, well, I'm in charge, or I'm in charge. Why? Well, both groups wanted to be the group to lead to independence. Well, things got so bad, so destructive, that some of the guys from the north bailed and some of the guys from the south bailed. They met up in the middle in Hue and they formed a third group called the Communist League of Indochina. This was not the Bolshevist-Leninist model. Communists were not supposed to kill each other. They were supposed to collaborate to topple the capitalist devils. So when word of what these groups were doing was transmitted back to Moscow, Moscow, the Comintern, sent word to Ho Chi Minh to do something about it. Now the problem is that he did kind of lose faith in the eyes of all of the leaders of the remnant groups, because he didn't stay to fight the fight. No, what did he do? He ran away. And then he had been in Siam for 2 years. Did he reach out? Did he contact him? Did he do anything? No. The word coward apparently was applied. But nonetheless, the three splinter groups were dependent on money from Russia. So when Russia ordered Ho to gather them together, they all responded. February 23rd, leaders from the different groups traveled to China and Hong Kong at a conference held at the Huayan College with the goal of bringing the three groups back together. This, in Vietnamese communist history, is known as the Unification Conference of 1930. Ho was the primary speaker, and he basically ordered all of the three groups to merge into a single new group, the Dong Chong San Vietnam. The Communist Party of Vietnam. There wouldn't be one in the north, there wouldn't be one in the south, there wouldn't be in the... No, they're all one party. Now, the funny thing is, Ho did not declare that he would be the leader. Rather, he would just act as the arbiter. So if the southern cells had an issue with something the central cells were doing, they would go to him rather than fight one another. And he would give an answer. But he didn't take command control. This allowed him to essentially build the vision for the revolution. Building upon his ideas and his path to socialism, Ho at the Unification Conference would lay out his 10 points. These were the measurable goals of the Communist Party of Vietnam. No more, no less. The first goal was independence. The first goal was to overthrow French imperialism, Vietnamese feudalism, and any reactionary bourgeoisie that were there. The system would be toppled. Then a new independent state would be created. So not within the communist, the French Empire, but it would break away and be its own nation. The government would be comprised of an alliance, just like in the Soviet Union. The workers, the peasants, the soldiers. They would make Soviets, councils. They would rule Vietnam from north to south. All private property would be seized. The banks, the different industries, the businesses. The state would take over everything and basically turn them over to the workers or the peasants or the soldiers. The state seizes the means of production. They would do the same thing in the countryside. All of the farms, all of the foreign-owned property would be seized and redistributed, divided up equally amongst all of the peasants. Then the state would regulate life. An 8-hour workday was implemented by law. All unjust taxes, particularly those that crippled the poor, would be eliminated. Then, once liberated, all of the democratic freedoms would be provided to the people. Freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of expression, consciousness, and the rest. And to make sure the people didn't turn to chaos, the state would properly educate people in the right ideas, the right values. And then, last but not least, there would be true equality, even amongst the genders. This was radical when you put it up to the traditional values of Vietnamese society. Traditionally, the Vietnamese people, to a degree, kind of embraced Confucianism, like they have in China. You know, that people weren't recognized by their class. They were just better than the people who were below them. Filial piety, as it's known as. But now these guys are coming in saying, nope, we're going to destroy everything and remake society in a socialist utopian vision. Well, apparently, he was so artful in the way he set these points out, and so forceful that not a single delegate who was present voted against a single measure. They unanimously approved, and they pledged, these are the goals of the revolution. The only hiccup that they ran into is when the name was submitted to the Comintern didn't like the Communist Party of Vietnam. The reason being, Indochina, if you recall, was made up also of Laos and Cambodia. So the Comintern basically ordered them to change their name. Instead, it would become the Dang Kong San Dong Duong. The Indochinese Communist Party. So they would spread to Laos and Cambodia, Siam, the rest of Indochina. But we'll just simply remember them as the ICP. So now the fractured cells are united. They're spreading the revolutionary message. They are trying to create this colony-wide revolution. Well, it's great. You have a group, you have some rah-rah slogans, but why on earth would anyone want to follow these guys? The truth be told, for their first 5, 6, 7 years, they didn't really do much. On a big scale, they didn't achieve the Grand Revolution. Ironically, up until 1935, membership never exceeded 1,500. You know, yeah, I'm sorry, if you're going to do a revolution, you're going to have more than 1,500 men and women in your group. If you're going to try taking over a country of millions. But they tried, and they would try to exploit whenever there was a chaos or a bad event. As I'm gonna butcher the quote, but I'll give it my best. An operative for Barack Obama, Rahm Emanuel, he once famously said, "Never allow a bad event to go unexploited," or something like that. Basically, if bad things happen, that's when you exploit them. You take advantage of them
for political reasons.
And there were some opportunities for the ICP. For instance, 1929, 1930, climate change struck Southeast Asia. Too much rain, very poor harvests. So because the peasants were dependent upon growing food when little food was being produced, they couldn't afford to pay their bills. So the landlord started coming in and repossessing the land, driving the peasants off the fields. So as a result, there was an attempt by the ICP to make inroads with the peasants, to radicalize them, to get them involved in this revolutionary movement. In other words, let's blame the man. Once they felt they had support, they would actually attempt to do something that happens all around the world. May 1st is Global Communist Day, commonly referred to as May Day. And it's when unions and laborers and members of the working class basically take to the streets in March demanding more rights. We had May Day events in our country at the beginning of the 20th century. But our political powers that be figured the best way to disassociate May Day with the communists is to give them Labor Day. We don't celebrate on May Day. We celebrate Labor Day. And that comes from the government, not the commies. Well, try as they might, the ICP tried linking conditions of the factory workers to the conditions in the fields. And lo and behold, as the days went by, starting on May 1st, some of the small marches would eventually see more people coming out to support them, turning into massive rallies, where instead of a few hundred people marching down the street holding signs and banging drums and shouting slogans, soon thousands of people came out to support them. Activity in cities, in particular, started grinding to a halt. Well, the French weren't going to tolerate that. So what did they do? They called out the military. And the government would begin opening fire on the crowds, killing dozens. Well, this played right into the hands of the ICP. Because who's the bad guy? You know, it's not the government that tries to maintain law and order. No, it's always, oh, the big bad government. It's all the poor people. So what if the people were, like, causing chaos? So ironically, this caused more people to want to join the ICP, which created a tit-for-tat situation. The more the people came out, the more the French responded. And by 1931, after dealing with this, colonial authorities would unleash the full strength of their military. They would brutally repress the protesters. Instead of single shots, they pulled out the and started mowing people down in the street. And by doing so, it caused the people who might have been inclined to join the ICP to basically take a step back and say, I don't want to end up dead. The worst happened outside of Hanoi in September 1931. The French military opened up and basically killed almost everybody in the village. 1,300 people dead. Well, it wasn't long before the ICP was almost destroyed completely. French agents then began trying to locate Ho in his base in Siam. Well, Ho once again somehow got word, so he managed to flee to China again. But unfortunately, the French would condemn him as a revolutionary. Here's how it works under international law. Hong Kong at this time was controlled by the British. The French couldn't just send in agents and go find him. That would be a violation of international law. But if someone gets declared via Interpol a revolutionary, that hits all of the country's wires. And all of the nations that have friendly agreements will work together to find these revolutionaries. So when the Brits got word, they actually tracked Ho down. And at one point, they actually got him. Brought him to prison, was going to be put on trial and then extradited to Vietnam. But friends managed to basically bribe the guards, help Ho escape, and once again, they put him on a ship and got him back to Moscow. This is the second time in 5 years, Ho goes back to Russia, a failure. The leaders of the ICP, who had to retreat to the deepest jungles in Vietnam, once again began calling Ho a coward. They removed him from all leadership positions in the party. Because they felt that Ho's nationalism was once again trumping his communism. They also declared the ICP. That if they find Ho in Vietnam, they'd shoot him. Imagine forming a group and then getting kicked out and having a target put on your back by that group. Well, unfortunately, that was the position that Ho found him in. And as for the ICP, they would lay low for a couple of years, and then in 1935, they would slowly begin to reform. But they did not take action. So they stayed in the jungles. They engaged in training. They engaged in recruiting peasants. But they didn't try engaging in any open protests or anything else that would get them shot. And they would remain under the radar for the next 5 years. Questions? So then what about Ho? How did he get back to Vietnam? Because if we recall, at the beginning of the class, Ho was in Vietnam when he met the OSS. Well, the opportunity for Ho to come back was World War II. World War II was a game changer. The reason being is France's ability to maintain an iron fist on Vietnam was stymied. Because when war erupted in 1939, France had to devote all its resources in Europe. Because they were dealing with the Nazis and the Blitzkrieg. And in case you've never studied World War II, you know, the beginning of the war in September 1939, when Nazi tanks rolled into Poland. After that, there was no action. From the fall into the winter into the following spring, no battles took place. But then the moment the spring occurred, Hitler unleashed his war machine. They toppled Denmark, the Netherlands, Belgium, Norway, and of course, France. France fell in June 1940, allowing Hitler to, for the only time in his life, travel to Paris and marvel at all of the artworks and the monumental architecture that dots the City of Lights. Well, here's the catch. The Nazis would occupy one-third of France, all of the land on the coast, the English Channel. But the portion that's in the southeast, that borders the Mediterranean, that would become an allied state called Vichy France. And the Vichy government joined the Axis, which now technically meant that the friends of the Nazis were in control of Vietnam. Go figure. But that situation would be short-lived because at the same time the tanks are ripping across Europe, war erupts in the Pacific. Also in 1937, my bad. Imperial Japan invaded China, triggering what's known as the Second Sino-Japanese War. Just as the Nazis were rolling across Europe, Imperial Japanese forces not only pushed into China, but they swept throughout the Pacific, seizing British and Dutch and French colonies. By the end of 1940, the Japanese arrived in Indochina and would seize control of the region. But the Japanese didn't fight the Vichy. Instead, they made an alliance of sorts. The Japanese would control Indochina, but the French soldiers would run the day-to-day operations. So now technically the Japanese in charge, but the French were still there. But the French didn't care for the Japs and vice versa. There was a lot of tensions between the two. Although they were struggling against one another for control of the region, this forced the ICP into an even more precarious situation. Because the Japanese and the Axis was waging a war on communism. 1940, Operation Barbarossa. 1941. The Nazi war machine invaded the Soviet Union. The Japanese were fighting the Chinese communists. So the ICP knew they didn't stand a chance. So they would attempt to go into hiding, but many of their leaders were caught and killed. Well, after 4 years, and about 2,000 party members were executed, including the leaders that voted against Ho, Ho realized, I have an opportunity. So he realized now was the time to finally return to his home country and to begin the push for independence. But before he went, he traveled to China. He went to Yan'an province and would actually stay with Mao Zedong, the leader of the Chinese communists, where he would receive guerrilla training, how to fight guerrilla techniques. I don't think it was supposed to snow today. I know it was going to get cold, but holy gosh, it's winter.
Groundhog did see a shadow,
so we've got 6 more weeks of this stuff.
Why would you do that?
Because he wants you to be cold. Ho also received pledges of friendship from his allied communist revolutionary. So by having these connections, Ho would establish an easy conduit to receive guns, bullets, medicines. After 2 years of training, he would come associated with 2 lieutenants who would be with him all the way through to the end. On the left is Vo Nguyen Giap. Giap was a former history teacher who joined the ICP in 1936. Now, the funny thing about us history geeks is that we have a tendency to read lots of books. And Giap was able to read the works of men like Sun Tzu in The Art of War, and Napoleon, and George Washington, and other basic successful military leaders. He soon started writing for the communist papers stories on military tactics, military methods. He would actually bump into Ho in China after the French basically targeted his little cell in northern Vietnam. He would train with Ho, train with the communist soldiers under Mao Zedong. And when Ho went back to Vietnam, Vo Nguyen Giap would be the commander-in-chief of the military forces. On his right is Pham Van Dong. Pham knew Ho for many, many years. Their friendship dated all the way back to 1925. He was actually an early member of the Thanh Nhai, the Vietnamese Revolutionary Youth Association. He had been in China with Ho, took his classes, and when the Chinese nationalists came in and destroyed the base, he stayed in China. But eventually he would make his way into Vietnam. While Vo Nguyen Giap was in the north, Pham Van Dong would go to Saigon. And he would start making connections in the south. But 1936, he gets caught by the French. He gets put in prison. Eventually, once released, he would move to Hanoi, where he met Giap, and in 1939, they traveled together to China. He would become Ho's finance officer. So you can't win a revolution unless you got a military strategist and you got a money man. Well, there you go. There is the keys to Vietnam's eventual success in those three men. Oh, by the way, while also in China, that's when he adopted the name Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh means the bringer of light. He hoped to bring the light of freedom to his people. And lastly, on this page, I think, 1941, for the first time since Ho Chi Minh left in 1911, 30 years, he would set foot on his home nation's soil, going into the northern region of Tonkin. Once there, the trio and a few other comrades decided to establish a militia, a fighting force to go with the Indo-Chinese Communist Party. This would be called the Vietnam Doc Lap Dong Minh Hoi. Rolls off the tongue. The League for an Independent Vietnam. But as I did with the other name, it's known to history as the Viet Minh. Why didn't they stick with the name Communist? Why did they change it to the League for an Independent Vietnam? Well, Ho realized, and he always realized, the importance of nationalism. Nationalism does not divide the people. Nationalism unites the people. Because instead of focusing on what you have that's different, you focus on what you have the same. You're all from the same place. You all have the same values. You have the same traditions, the same history. So Ho was smart enough, he didn't want this to be a communist party. He wanted it to be a nationalist party. So he began trying to bring in all patriots, everyone against the French and or the Japanese. So coincidentally, throughout its lifetime, the Vietnamese was more of a nationalist group than it was a communist. He opened the doors to everyone. Soldiers or workers or peasants, sure. But he also invited intellectuals and government workers and merchants and young men and women. If you wanted to overthrow the French jackals and the Japanese fascists, join his group. The difference was he learned his lesson with the ICP. He would be declared the leader of the Viet Minh. He wasn't going to get kicked out of this party or labeled a traitor by this party. No, no, he was here to stay. And Gap and Dong would be his cohorts to bring about this victory. Questions? So we have the new focus. We're starting to build a new group. We have the new cause. Would they do swimmingly? Hell no. How far did I get? Not really. It would grow slowly. Because who in their right mind wanted to get shot by the French or the Japanese? But by 1944, it's estimated that they had about 500,000 members throughout all of Vietnam. And how do they do it? How do they go from a small guerrilla band to something big? Well, I've already said it. They didn't try to take people's stuff. They didn't do that communist stuff. They found common cause. Do you hate being controlled by the Japanese? Do you hate being controlled by the French? Do you want to be free? Plus, truth be told, one of the things that allowed them to grow slowly over time was the fact that, as I said before, the French were butting heads with the Japanese. So technically, no one was really in charge of the country. And all the while, they would remain laser focused. Japanese was always named as the primary target. Because by focusing on the Japanese, now suddenly the Viet Minh are in the same sphere as not only the Soviet Union, who's fighting the Nazis in the Axis, not only the British, who are fighting the Nazis in the Axis, but on December 7th, 1941, America is in the game. So now Ho Chi Minh had the opportunity to basically say to all of them, we're on the same side. But as it turns out, when you actually look at the core of the Viet Minh, the leaders were mostly from the ICP. So even though they talked in nationalist language, the core was red. he continued to use the original model. You had at the center the tight-knit group, the leaders of the movement that would spread out and recruit across the country, like I drew with my awesome artwork.
And by the way, some of these communists, they wanted full-blown communist revolution. They wanted to go out to take the streets. They wanted to engage in acts of violence. But Ho was patient.
And no one was going to go against Ho. His favorite saying, when asked, how come we're not going to attack? Just simple.
A revolution is like the rising tide. The reliable elements are like the piling sunk into the riverbed. It is they who will maintain the soil at low tide.
If we go out and attack, our leaders are going to get killed, like the leaders of every single group that tried it before. No, no. We're going to stay embedded, and we're going to wait. Because just because the tide's high, the tide will eventually go out. But then it will rise again. Wait for the right time. So what did they do? They're gathering people. They're growing their group. But if they're not attacking, what are they doing? Well, ironically, they did do some guerrilla operations. They did do some sabotage. Broke railroad tracks, broke some bridges, chopped trees down to block roads, things like that. But the primary activity that they engaged in was intelligence gathering. One of the most important things that they did was they kept track of not only where the Japanese were in Vietnam, but they recruited women, cleaning ladies, who went in and cleaned the Japanese offices to get pictures of Japanese plans, to try to listen in when they were talking, to try to glean intelligence to help with the war effort.
They also knew the jungle.
So what would happen frequently is that the Allies, particularly the Americans, would try to do bombing raids on Japanese positions. But they would send the bombers out with just enough fuel to get to the targets. But they would always have a plan to ditch the plane somewhere. One of the most frequent locations to try to ditch these bombers was Vietnam. Because once you get beyond the coast, it's nothing but jungle. So one of the things that the Viet Minh would do is whenever they heard that American planes were coming, they'd go out into the jungles and they would rescue the pilots.
We also have the story that I shared in the very, very beginning of class. In April 1930, Major Archimedes Patty of the American OSS parachuted into friendly airspace and would eventually meet the general, Ho Chi Minh, in which they would establish friendly relations.
Now, as I said, Agents Patty and others, they were impressed by Ho. They found him likable. Because whenever he came across Americans, he wanted to talk American history. He talked about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. In fact, one OSS agent
described Ho this way. He was an awfully sweet guy. If I had to pick out the one quality about that little guy sitting on his hill in the jungle, it was his gentleness.
But of course, unbeknownst to them, his gentleness was nothing but a ruse.
Questions?
This is gonna end. Is that the next one going? Will get us to the point where I wanted to end for the first test.
Patty meets Ho in April
30th, 1945. The war itself would be over soon.
Coincidentally, in May 5th or 6th or 7th, I don't remember the date off my head, that was VE Day.
So just a week or two after Patty met Ho Chi Minh, the war in Europe would come to an end.
But the war in Asia was still raging. There was estimates that the Japanese would continue to fight until 1948. They still had millions of soldiers spread out throughout the entire Pacific. And they were busy building up the defenses of the home islands. In July 1945, the Allied leaders met at Potsdam to try to figure out what were they going to do. How were they going to basically knock Japan out of the war. And according to popular legend, it was at this meeting that Harry Truman apparently leaned over to Uncle Joe Stalin and said, "Wait till you see what we have." Well, coincidentally, Indochina was one of the many topics that they discussed. Because Indochina was a French colony, but the French were kind of like traitors. But the French economy was also destroyed. So the world leaders weren't quite sure what to do with this part of the world. So at Potsdam, a proposal was made in which Southeast Asia would basically be split at the 16th degree parallel. Basically, everything to the south would be occupied by the British. Everything to the north would be occupied by the nationalist Chinese forces under Chiang Kai-shek. And the plan was basically get the Japanese out, stabilize things, and
reestablish the French.
Then just a few weeks later, Harry let the world know what the United States had.
Not just one, but two atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, turning those cities to virtual glass, causing so much shock that the Japanese continue to fight for a few more days. But in the end, the Emperor of Japan made the decision to record a message to broadcast to his people that it was time to surrender. August 15th, World War II comes to an end. When that occurred, there was joy, jubilation, excitement around the earth. But the Vietnamese took advantage of the situation. The Viet Minh would launch what became known as the August Revolution. Tens of thousands of Viet Minh, armed and trained by the OSS, would come out of the jungle, march into Hanoi, and liberate the city. In the coming days, the revolution would spread throughout much of Tonkin. As they planned, revolutionary committees, Soviets, would be established throughout the countryside in an interconnecting network, allowing them to pursue or assume governmental control. On August 19th, the Japanese commander in charge of Hanoi would literally turn over the keys to the palace, to the Viet Minh. Eleven days later, the puppet emperor, the last ruler of the Nguyen dynasty, the 13th emperor, Bao Dai, would give up his throne. Now, ironically, the Japs did not interfere with the emperor. They let him stay there. One of the reasons why was that Bao Dai had no interest in actually governing. He was content living in the palaces, wearing silken robes and eating the food and drinking the wine. He was okay with that. He didn't want to be a leader of the people. But when the Viet Minh arrived, he too turned over the reins of power, giving to Ho Chi Minh the imperial seal. Now, ironically, Bao Dai would be put on a ship, would sail to France, where he would live in the Riviera until 1949, when the French brought him back. And this will be the last point, because we are at the end of class. Close enough. On September 2nd, Ho declared that North Vietnam would be an independent country, headquartered in Hanoi, known as the DRV, the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. Now, the funny thing is that the stories of what was going on in Hanoi are kind of funny. Because while all this was going on, not only do you still have the Japanese there surrendering, not only do you still have some French troops, but the Chinese marched in, under the Potsdam Agreement and attempted to occupy the city. But they didn't know what to do. So an uneasy truce broke out. But at the end of the day, they all acknowledged Ho was in charge. What would happen next? We'll have to wait and see. All right, so what my plan is I'm going to give you one more class, and then we'll have our first exam. This will give me a chance to put the exam together. So on Thursday, I will let you guys decide what day you want your exam on. Because it's remote, I will let you do it on Friday, or Saturday, or Sunday, or Monday. Your choice. But again, we'll decide that come Thursday. All right? All right. What's your name? What?
Jake Lantonis.
All right. Who else? DeMarcus. Awesome. Oh, and Dilkin. Still gonna keep her perfect streak, unlike last semester. All right, so just a reminder, the paper section's up, start giving that some thought. Most of you have given me topics. Some of you haven't, some of you I've replied to, but I need the topics, because I need to know what you're writing about. And if I don't have your topic set by Friday, I'll take points off your paper. So you gotta get it done, all right? All right, dismissed.